This is Vis-a-Vis, a podcast series brought to you by the Alliance Program at Columbia University. Vis-a-Vis features conversations that challenge our understanding of key global, economic, and social issues by casting them in a transatlantic perspective. I'm Emmanuel Catan. I head the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University and three French universities, Sciences Po, Paris Panthéon-Sorbonne, and École Polytechnique. Every episode, I sit down face-to-face with, or as we say in French, vis-a-vis, some of the most insightful thinkers on both sides of the Atlantic. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Since the storming of the Capitol on January 6, 2021, there have been growing fears about the risk of political violence in the United States. Efforts to cast doubt on the results of the election, combined with the spread of inflammatory rhetoric and increased polarization on social media, represent serious threats not only to civility, but to democracy itself. In his new book, co-authored with Brigitte Nakos and Yaeli Block-Elkin, Bob Shapiro, Columbia Professor of Political Science and Professor at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia, analyzes the origins of this polarization, its relationship with the media, and its impact on public life today. The book is called Hate Speech and Political Violence, Far-Right Rhetoric from the Tea Party to the Insurrection, and it is published by Columbia University Press. To explore these issues and what they mean in the current electoral cycle, Vis-a-Vis is honored to welcome Bob Shapiro. And before we start, let me say that this episode of Vis-a-Vis is being recorded on August 28th, 2024, 68 days before the presidential election. Much is bound to happen between now and then. Professor Shapiro, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
In your book, Hate Speech and Political Violence, you describe how the polarization and violence of political discourse in the U.S. has reached alarming levels in the last few years. And you identify some of the reasons why that has been the case. One of the turning points is the emergence of cable television in the 1980s, and then 10 years later, the emergence of 24-hour news channels, which has essentially siloed the American public and splintered it into different opinion groups. But you also point to another watershed, the emergence of the Tea Party after Barack Obama's election. This was a turning point when, as you say, political communication began to go into a toxic downward spiral. What exactly happened then?
Well, the thing that happened was that the existing partisan conflict and polarization that had begun in the United States since the 1970s reached a high point with Obama's election. And the Tea Party was a response to the Obama administration's policies with regard to taxes, bailing out the banks, healthcare reform, and so forth. But prior to that, there was a whole history that emerged in which, just to make a long story very short, the parties became ideologically different on all manner of issues. Back in the 1950s, the parties just differed on maybe big government, economic welfare type issues, and labor. But subsequent to that, with the emergence of the civil rights movement, with the civil rights movement on the agenda, and the Democratic Party becoming the party of civil rights, led by Lyndon Johnson, then as new issues emerged, it became the Liberal Party and everything else, and the Republican Party, the Conservative Party, and everything else. The one other piece, which I need to say quickly, is the parties also became much more competitive. As the South left the Democratic Party, elections began to become competitive, not only for the presidency, as they've always been, but also for the House of Representatives and the Senate. Beginning in 1980, the Republicans became competitive for the Senate. Had remained so ever since. 1994, competitive for control of the House after that debacle of a midterm election for Bill Clinton. And since then, the parties have been competitive for unified party control of government. Obama gets elected in a major election, a significant victory. He gets into office with a Democratic Congress, House of Representatives, and also, for a very brief period, a veto-proof Senate. He had 60 Senate seats. So he was able to do all manner of things to which the Tea Party responded, motivated by opposition to those issues. There were racial undercurrents there with Obama being the first black president of the United States, defeating John McCain, who was thought to be a formidable and heroic Republican candidate. I think that fact drove a lot of people a little bit crazy. And they were particularly crazed with the liberal policy agenda or the perceived liberal policy agenda of the Obama administration. So the Tea Party emerged in response to that. Racial overtones, anti-immigration, a certain kind of militancy that they were a part of. And at that moment in time, you had new media in play that enabled, for economic reasons, for the media to become partisan again, the way they had been in the 19th century, the emergence of Fox News, MSNBC News, and so forth, and other new news outlets emerged. And then going forward, there was also the emergence of social media. So you had the mainstream media, new media, which is cable, you had the internet, you had social media, and all of these media kind of fed off each other as well. And they were a way for the media to amplify the political conflict that occurred. Now, we could talk about biases in the media, liberal biases, conservative biases, but the big bias are biases in coverage that would produce large audiences because these media outlets are economic entities. And conflict sells, and the conflict got amplified substantially, and there was plenty of conflict to amplify.
Right. And your book is particularly about this, about conflict, and also about the risk of violent conflict.
And the amplification by the media.
So what is the connection between this, what you call this hyper-polarization, and the threat to democracy? How is there a threat to democracy because there's a threat to political institutions in the U.S., you know, Supreme Court, Congress, etc.? Yeah. Or is it because there's an erosion of trust between fellow citizens as well?
Well, there's an erosion of trust, but how we got there picks up from the story of partisan conflict that emerged. The partisan conflict that emerged because of the parties being different on issues, all of this becoming highly emotional because the parties were competitive, that is, the stakes in politics became greater. And as they became greater, they became much more emotional and they became much more personal. Mm-hmm. That is, what emerged in all this is what political scientists have called affective polarization, emotions toward the opposite, basically of partisans toward the opposite party. And that dislike of the opposite party emerged in a way that became highly emotional to the point where it affected individuals and political leaders' perceptions of reality. That is, people saw things through a partisan lens and would only tend to believe and magnify and accept the kinds of things that supported their policy issues. And we saw some of that during the Iraq War in 2003, where it was long the case that Republicans still thought, and the electorate thought, that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, even though that was disproven.
Dismissed.
Mm-hmm. And then, you know, fast forward a little bit further with Obama, you actually had the whole birther movement and the arguments that Obama was not a Christian, he was a Muslim, he was not born in the United States. These kinds of conspiracy theories emerged. And Republicans and Democrats differed in the extent to which they believed those things, to the extent that the best educated Republicans were more likely to believe falsehoods than the least well-educated Democrats. You have a situation where there's a highly emotional context to politics, different perceptions of reality, and this is where the rhetoric comes in. Trump comes in, and while the Tea Party changed the tone of politics, leading to much more bitter rhetoric, Trump took this to a much higher level in which he talked about, you know, beating up people and silencing people and things of that sort. He talked about immigrants as being the worst of the worst, rapists, murderers, and gang members and so forth. And so you had that heightening of rhetoric, and inevitably that kind of rhetoric could lead toward more violent action, especially where the rhetoric sort of insinuates that kind of action.
You mentioned the power of emotion and its relationship to the media. Where does identity come in relation to emotion and to electoral behavior in America today? To what extent is that electoral behavior, which sometimes is more likely to be determined by identity than by affinity with certain policy issues, to what extent is it determined also by a sense of threat, that this form of identity is under threat?
Well, there are multiple kinds of identities that we can talk about. We can talk about partisan identity, but these identities have tended to mesh in such a way that you have racial identity meshing with partisan identity. So when you talk about identity politics in the United States, you're talking about the threat to whites in the United States playing a big part in the responses. And you can see some of this in the Tea Party, and we saw this clearly with Trump, and we saw this clearly in the context context of all the hate groups and militant groups that have arisen.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Turning to the impact and the origins also of the inflammatory rhetoric, particularly on social media, you were mentioning, you know, the emergence also of conspiracy theories. An increasing number of those fake news and conspiracy theories can be traced back to foreign actors. And I think that in the current electoral cycle, this is, you know, one of the main preoccupations of both parties. To what extent do you think that this is a real danger currently?
I think the phenomenon you're talking about is very important. But in terms of the source being foreign actors, I would weight that much less heavily than sources that are indigenous in the United States. Mm-hmm. That is, there was a lot of talk about the Russian influence in the 2016 election. The Russians were trying to do a lot. There may have been other foreign entities trying to do things too. But the ultimate effect of what they were trying to do in terms of affecting the election results were likely to be pretty minimal in the context of all the other sources of information and messages being communicated. That is, individuals are, you know, talk about social media, they're getting information perhaps from Russians or bots, but they're also getting information from people's friends and families and groups that people are tied to or other people that they're connected through social media. So the foreign influences in that context, I think, were relatively small. The only possibility, and we'll never know this, is to what extent these foreign influences might have affected a certain subset of voters in a certain state of the United States enough to turn that state toward the Republicans. But in the context of the 2016 election, you know, turning one state toward the Republican, turning that back toward the Democrats wouldn't have made any difference.
And going back to the rhetoric, and you were mentioning Donald Trump's rhetoric and how it had hardened and coalesced at the very beginning around Barack Obama and doubts about his citizenship. How do you see this evolving? So how do you see Trump's and some of the Republican Party's rhetoric evolving since the 2020 election and into the current election cycle, and more specifically with the rise of Kamala Harris as the Democratic candidate? Do you see this rhetoric being adjusted and changing?
Okay, that's a lot to talk about. So the conspiracy theories involving Obama and whether he was born in the United States and whether he was a Christian or a Muslim or whatever existed. Trump comes on the scene and he's the leader in chief of the birther conspiracy. That, to make a long story short, helped him succeed ultimately as a presidential candidate. The kind of rhetoric associated with Trump, going back to the infamous, you know, tapes about his treatment of women and so forth, really changed the norms of what's acceptable rhetoric in politics, to the point where four-letter words can become very commonplace these days, even acceptable in certain contexts on mainstream media.
But not on the Vis-a-vis podcast, I should say.
I will keep it clean.
Right.
I will keep it clean. Basically, success bred success for him, and his followers adopted those kinds of things as well. Fast forward to his election and his administration, you basically saw a lot more of that. I've been studying affective partisanship. It was clearly the case that from 2016 to 2020, affective partisanship, these bad feelings toward the members of the other party, increased pretty significantly in the context of dislike for Trump and the Republicans among Democrats, and the same among Republicans toward the Democrats. Now, fast forwarding to the present, I think we may see soon the increase in the hostile tone of rhetoric that emerges, especially in the context of a very close election. What we have seen thus far from Trump, his, you know, subtle or not so subtle references to rape, his continued accusations of immigrants and so forth at the southern border being rapists, murderers, and thieves and gang members and so forth, using the harshest rhetoric toward them. Whether that expands further, we'll see going forward. But a lot of this was perhaps easier for the Trump campaign to level toward Biden. Kamala Harris changes things in a very dynamic way, and we'll have to see what happens going forward. I think what it'll be interesting to see, especially what happens in the debates.
Right, right. So turning to some of the other sources of influence on the debate, on the current electoral debate, according to conventional wisdom, American presidential elections generally are fought on the home front, and foreign policy issues tend to have less weight than issues that are related to the economy and employment, standards of living, etc. With regards to the current conflict in the Middle East, and particularly given how polarized this issue is both on the political front and in the media, do you think that it will weigh more heavily in the minds of electors? And I'd say, particularly young people and swing voters, because they really hold the cards with regards to the results of this election.
Okay, in terms of the Middle East, when I talked about how the parties have become different on all issues, this has included foreign policy issues, and beginning with 9/11, the Democratic and the Republican Party basically were perceived as taking different positions with regard to the Middle East. The overall consensus, bipartisan consensus, is still support for Israel, but some segment of the Democratic Party has been increasingly hostile to Israel and more favorably disposed toward the Palestinians. So there's a partisan gap in public opinion with respect to sympathy for each side in the Middle East. Within the Democratic Party, there's a split, and that split could have significant consequences in the election. We know from the existing survey data that members of minority groups are more supportive of Palestine than whites. We also know that younger adults are more supportive of the Palestinians than of Israel. And those groups have been a central and a very important part of the Democratic base that basically helped propel, you know, Biden to the presidency in that very close election in 2020. Harris needs support of those groups in the current election and needs support for those groups in the critical states of Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, Nevada, and North Carolina. That's what we're talking about here. These groups exist in all those states to different degrees. There's also the Arab American and Palestinian American community that exists in the United States, especially in Michigan, Dearborn, Detroit, and so forth. Those voters can make a significant difference in the election. We saw what happened at the Democratic National Convention, where those individuals and groups were basically, in a sense, shut out. There was some commentary acknowledging the situation and what they were saying and doing about it. But the opposition to the Democrats here is almost personal. That is, these opponents of what Israel is doing in Gaza feel betrayed by the Biden administration. Anecdotally, individuals said in interviews and in focus groups and the like that they would even vote for Trump to spite Biden.
Right.
Okay. So that tells you the severity of that. But the key question is that where will it matter? And among what voters will it matter? And we talked about the groups, but it's the groups in particular states mm-hmm. that we have to watch.
Right. Right. And do you think that this might mark a shift in the longer term in terms of what issues count with regards to American elections? I mean, I don't want you to speculate necessarily about what will happen in the next 20 years, but it seems to me that perhaps given the diversity of the makeup of American society, foreign policy issues are likely perhaps to play a greater role in future elections. Do you think that's the case?
Well, the general rule of thumb here is that foreign policy issues don't matter until they do.
Right.
Okay. And so in the current context, if the election comes down to the state of Michigan and you can identify, you know, Arab Americans and Palestinian Americans as being a key group, then there's a consequence there. Typically, foreign policy issues don't matter unless they're an issue of crisis level proportion, like the Korean War and the Vietnam War, where the effects could be major nationally. And also in the 2006 midterm election, for example, the souring of the Iraq War really hurt the Republicans. I don't think issues of the scale of the plight of the Palestinians in Gaza would normally have a big effect on an election. But going forward, one thing we've learned is that the future is very hard to predict.
Right, right, indeed. So going back to your book, you analyze the motives of groups such as the Proud Boys and other organizations intent on political violence, and you explore their role in trying to prevent the certification of Joe Biden's victory and the threats that they pose to democracy before and after the storming of the Capitol on January 6th. How do you assess the significance of these groups today? How active are they in the background of the current campaign? And do they still, in your mind, represent a threat?
Due to the arrests that were made after the January 6th assault on the Capitol, a lot of the leadership of that group has basically been put in jail. Okay. That said, the groups themselves are completely alive and well. And it's not just the formal groups. That is, there are other militants out there and people predisposed toward militant behavior. A lot of the people who participated in January 6th weren't part of a group. They went there and behaved in different ways, some obviously more violent than others. Those groups are still out there. Those people with those predispositions are still out there. You have Donald Trump questioning about whether he'll accept the results of the 2024 election. All the ingredients are still there. I mean, to the point, and Brigida Nakos kind of reminded me of this, that the president of the Heritage Foundation, Kevin Roberts, said in an interview, "We're in the process of the second American Revolution, which will remain bloodless if the left allows it to be." So the insinuation there is that there are forces out there that could make this a bloody revolution. Granted, you have the militant groups that challenged the results of the 2020 election. There are possibly individuals out there, you know, on the left that have to be watched as well in this particular context.
Right. And building on this, you know, everything will hinge, as you say at the end of the book, in the postscript, if I remember well, everything will hinge on the outcome of the November 2024 presidential election. Independent of who wins, you know, the critical issue will be, you know, whether there will be controversy over the vote and the result of the election. Do you feel that there is, first of all, trust on the part of the American people in their electoral system? And again, to dig deeper into this issue, how likely is it that a controversy over the election result will lead to political violence in your mind?
Well, in general, there's trust in the administration of elections in the United States, particularly when it comes to less controversial local and state offices that aren't embroiled in the current partisan conflict, although state politics now has become much, much more partisan as well. There's been this nationalization of state politics. But the trust that we're talking about here is contentious. That is, Republicans and Democrats different in their perceptions of trust of institutions, with the Democrats more trusting than the Republicans, maybe in the context of who won the 2020 election and what's happened since. The militant groups pose a threat, but the greater threat is posed by political leaders and elected officials who might be inclined to challenge the elections. Now, what you have out there is you have the bureaucratic election administrators who are basically going to try to do the best they can to administer a free and fair election. I would assume there's a lot of built-up trust for them in most states, except for, of course, the contentious states that may matter most. But where the threat is coming in at this point are from elected officials in the states, or elected and appointed officials in the states, who are poised to question the results of the election and to block the certification of the electors in those states. And that's something that's going to come first before anything escalates. There's going to be that particular determination. And ultimately, that may lead to a battle that's fought in the courts. And the question will there be other extracurricular activity of the sort that we saw on January 6th that emerges? And to what extent the Republicans and Donald Trump may pursue implicitly or explicitly those kinds of things. We're assuming for the moment that the Democrats are going to be concerned with voter suppression and less concerned with the initial counts of the elections. But it's the Republicans now that are really taking action, putting people in place to block the certification. And that's where the threat is. There's a huge difference, though, between this election and the last election. In the last election, Donald Trump was running for president as president of the United States. In this election, Joe Biden is the president of the United States. If anything happens and there has to be any response to any kind of militant activity, Biden is the one who's going to be in a position to call out the National Guard. And you would expect a very different response than what you saw in 2020. Keeping in mind also, and this is ironic, the Supreme Court has given presidents immunity for the kinds of things they might do in their role acting as presidents. Biden, at least in principle, has free rein as to what he can do with immunity. Now, of course, he's very different from Donald Trump and would never do such a thing.
Right. Right.
Yes, we assume. But in terms of where the power lies, in terms of what happens after the election, it's not in Trump's hands.
And the role of the electoral officials that you mentioned in certifying the vote, can this potentially delay the actual certification of the election result?
Yeah, it can. In principle, the rules are set up that they have to act quickly and the courts have to have time to respond. But you know, delays can occur in these things, whether intentionally or unintentionally.
Right, right, right. And finally, a question really to focus our gaze on hope. Where do you see the possibility of restoring trust in political institutions and the electoral process that we were just mentioning? And in particular, how do you respond to the threat of uncivil language and inflammatory rhetoric, as you have described in your book? What can be done to restore civility in the political debate in America?
Well, I can become famous if I had a solution to the problem. Political scientists have thought about ways of changing electoral rules to help moderate politics. Those kinds of things haven't worked out very effectively. There are all kinds of proposals about ways of getting people to interact with people on the other side in non-political environments to basically lead to ways of easing tension. I had the thought that it might be through population replacement, more diversity in the population, and also generational turnover, where new generations may take over and end the current craziness. I don't think there's any evidence that those things will have that kind of effect. The problems were caused by the behavior of political leaders, to start with. I mean, we can debate whether it's leaders responding to publics or what have you, but it's the behavior of leaders. And to get us out of this mess requires, I think, a sea change on the part of political leaders, where you have leaders on both sides saying, enough. This has to end. We're destroying the greatest nation in the world. That's a little bit of pie in the sky, and I'll believe it when I see it. But I think at this point, it really does come down to leadership.
And you think
and leadership beginning at the highest levels and penetrating to leadership at lower levels.
And you think that there is a real groundswell among the American population to see that kind of change in the quality of leadership in America?
Because of the partisan nature of politics, it would have to be leaders on both sides kind of coming together and saying enough is enough. Now, we saw that there were occasions that occurred, like 9/11, COVID, that should have been events, situations that would lead to the nation pulling together and the parties working together and ending the conflict. Now, after 9/11, there was a brief period where you saw some of that. The COVID crisis was an opportunity for Donald Trump to do that, but he wasn't up to the task. He didn't handle it in that particular way.
Great. Well, listen, on that note, thank you so much, Professor Shapiro. This has been really inspiring and very thought-provoking. Can I remind our listeners that your book, co-authored with Brigitte Nakos and Yaeli Block-Elkin, is called Hate Speech and Political Violence, Far-Right Rhetoric from the Tea Party to the Insurrection, and it is published by Columbia University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Vis-a-vis is brought to you by the Alliance Program, a partnership between Columbia University, Paris Panthéon Sorbonne, Sciences Po, and École Polytechnique. This podcast is produced by Monica Hunter-Hart and Georgia O'Neill, and I'm Emmanuel Catan. Special thanks to Columbia Libraries. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. If you're interested in learning more about the Alliance Program and how we support academic exchanges, research, and collaboration between the US and France, please visit us at alliance.columbia.edu or follow us on Facebook, Twitter X, and Instagram. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening.